Greetings, everybody. Welcome to Flywheel, your number one source for everything crypto, DeFi, and all that's in between. If you want to know what's going on in the world on chain, you've come to the right place. This is DeFi Dave here with capital K, and we are here to help you harness the power of the flywheel. And this time, imagine a flywheel, but on a waterfall, because we go over, and that will be relevant in the interview, trust me. We go over stablecoin go-to-markets, what the signal waterfall is, and how perception drives results. So we have on Studi from Kraken Ventures, probably like one of the most finger to the pulse people I know, like keeping track of stablecoins, like that are launching, that are already launched. She like is all, I feel like I've had so many conversations with her already. She's like just forever curious about them. And I think that really like shows in the results and in the, like the projects that Kraken Ventures are a part of. So Kit, what are your quick thoughts on this one?
Philosopher builders.
Yeah. If you read Plato's Republic, this is the one for the word cells, everyone.
Yeah.
The initial one that was for the shape road haters. This one
but
is for
fun. I had fun.
Yeah. Initial will be next week. This is for the word cells. Yeah, I have fun on every episode, so I had fun on this. Yep. Anyways, before we get into it, make sure you go ahead, hit that bell button, subscribe, give us a like, go in the comments, let us know what you think, please. I want to hear from you. I miss you. go ahead and go to our Twitter, TikTok, and Telegram, at Flywheel DeFi. Go follow us over there right now. Follow me on Twitter while you're there, at DeFiDays22.
Follow me at 0xCapital_K.
And let's get the flywheel spinning. All right. GM. Welcome back to Flywheel, everyone. I'm your host, DeFi Dave, here, as always, with capital K. And this time around the Flywheel, we have on Studi from Kraken Ventures. Studi is probably one of the most mindful, not just stablecoin, but DeFi VCs I know. I think we met like around a year ago in Paris, and you were telling me a bit about your lore. I was like, oh, damn, this is like such a natural crypto story. And I feel like whenever like some new innovative stablecoin's out, I always see like Kraken Ventures like right there. I'm like, oh, of course, that's Studi. So Studi, you've been on CNBC, and now you have graced us on Flywheel. It's an honor to have you on. Thank you for coming.
God, thank you for having me here. And I think I'm really speaking to my people this time around.
Let's go.
Yes. One of us.
This is the money nerds. This is for the money nerds, this podcast. But before we get into the money, we're going to get into your background. So like, how'd you get into crypto? What were you doing before? And how'd you specifically get into stablecoins?
Sure. Okay. So I actually have a number of careers before crypto, and I don't want to bore you with all of them, but basically, you know, some of the work I did, it was in finance, automotive, startups, venture capital. So I'll just like cover that thread really quickly first. I started in infrastructure finance, and that was after I graduated from CMU. I was basically sizing, pricing, issuing debt on behalf of government and municipal entities. That job brought me to San Francisco, and you know, I was always quite interested in tech. You know, both my parents were computer scientists, also involved in like open source communities. And I went to a very early stage mobility startup that was later acquired by an automaker. And you know, during this period of time, I had an interest in robotics and really like the potential that it has to solve some of the economic models around like urban mobility. And I received a very fortuitous call in 2017 from Berlin, Germany, and that was from Volkswagen Group. And that was to start an autonomous mobility team for them in Germany. So I ended up moving in 2017. And my work there culminated in like a $2.5 billion like acquisition of a self-driving software company. And then, you know, I kind of decided at that time that being an automotive lifer was never on my career bingo card. So I decided to transition to venture capital, basically to work more closely with entrepreneurs and engage my interest in investing and the startup community. So that's basically my life before crypto, right? Or even during crypto. So now back to crypto. So I absolutely loved all of the day jobs that I had. But once I moved to Berlin, at night, I became increasingly enthralled with crypto and blockchain and the community that was forming over there around it. You know, it reminded me a lot of like the open source software idealism that I had grown up around. And this is very much a story for another time. And I don't even know if like, you know this, but you know, I had a moment in my late teens where I was actually running with some semi-anarchist groups. And I actually took time off of college because of it as well. So many of the decentralization and self-sovereign aspects of, you know, blockchain also appealed to me. So during that time, Berlin really felt like the center of gravity for crypto, like for the entire crypto universe. I'm not sure. Did you guys spend time there, kind of that 2016 through 19 era?
No, I was just in LA.
Berlin Blockchain Week was huge.
Yeah, I was just getting my feet wet in LA. I couldn't even think about traveling then.
You know, I was like lucky to be there. But Berlin at that time, it was anchored by like a few major organizations. So there was like a big Ethereum Foundation dev presence there. Parity and Polkadot had spun off of that as well over there. And Tendermint core teams were there too. Wow. So I started going to meetups, tried to find ways to become involved. And really it was like the zeitgeist of Berlin at that time, the way, you know, right now, like AI is for SF.
Yeah.
And so all of my friends were, you know, doing it as well. So I basically tried to find ways to like include it in my job, even though my job had nothing to do with this. And, you know, I was doing education for like, you know, management at VW Group, facilitating pilots and POCs with some of these companies in the ecosystem. And a lot of the focus at that time was on the tech. And that was like supply chain transparency, permissioned access management. And conceptually, I thought they were very promising, especially at that time, but they didn't scale. And later I felt this was because of, you know, the walled gardens that crypto, corporate crypto was building on, lack of community that it had. And, you know, it really fancied corporate logos over that community as well. Right. And this like left me a bit disillusioned. So then come like kind of 2020, 2021, that's around when I had my aha moment. So at that time I was rotating through community and hacker houses in San Francisco. I was thinking of moving back. And I kept coming across researchers and builders and yield farmers in crypto. And I started to dig back in and learned about the emerging DeFi ecosystem. Like, you know, it was the DeFi summer, you had all the food coins. And it was just such a transformation for me. Like this cycle was less weighted on like the cryptography aspects and much more on economics and interesting incentive design. And how to use crypto to actually incentivize actions from the community. So I decided to leave my job and was spending my free time just like reading, researching, doing some trading. I had a few alts on Twitter that I was using to engage with various communities. Also because, nice. You know, much of this time or before that, I still had my day job. I didn't really want them to know how much time I was spending on this.
Many such cases.
Exactly. And I was actually called out once when I was like tweeting from my main. So I was like, all right, forget it. I deleted like everything on my main and just like came up with some alts. And in that time, I became especially curious around stablecoin design. So it looped me back to infrastructure finance and monetary policy in some ways as well. And I had some friends at that time basically encourage me to step out from behind my computer and start going to events. But because, as I said, I was pretty much just, you know, behind these alts. So I ended up at a women's crypto brunch in Miami. And in that time, I met a mainstream media journalist. And we chatted in particular at length about stables. And basically, a few weeks later, Terra Luna collapsed. And I ended up on CNBC explaining the dynamics behind it, which was, you know, quite fortuitous and unexpected. I basically reposted this on my social media. And this is how I got connected to Kraken Ventures, landing me my current job in crypto as an early stage VC investor.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow.
I love how we came full circle back to InfraFi, but instead of InfraFi in the real world, it was like, oh, like
on-chain infra. DeFi.
On-chain. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I have just one request. I think my dog found a way to get into this room. Can I just like let her out for a second?
Yeah, can we say hi? Sure.
Come here.
We love special guests.
We'll post her online later. Yeah. One sec.
Okay. Yeah. It's like when my dog comes. And we're so back. All right.
We're so back. Yeah.
Okay. So now you're at Kraken Ventures. And Okay. At ETHCC, at Stable Summit this year, you gave this presentation about stablecoin go-to-markets and your thesis around go-to-markets. Can you, and I found this like very interesting, especially coming off like this current leg of the cycle and the launch of stablecoins such as Athena, which was a Kraken Ventures investment. There were other ones like Usual had like a run-up as well. And you basically provided a framework on how stablecoins can go on chain and go to the market, get mind share, get liquidity, get attention, get everything that matters. Can you explain your go-to-market thesis for stablecoins?
Yeah, absolutely. So generally, to contextualize this, go-to-market is the process of bringing your product and your brand to your target customer segments, your market. Generally, like I think people follow the like four P's of marketing, which is product, price, place, promotion. So what distinguishes DeFi go-to-market from that of traditional tech is that in DeFi, often perception drives reality. So because of DeFi's user-owned model, people actually want to align their usage with projects that they believe will also be market winners. So the perceived potential success of a product also drives people to use it, buying the governance tokens, farming points, becoming power users. So this early adoption begets liquidity, which drives credibility and positive attention to a project, which then begets further liquidity. And this is what I call the attention liquidity flywheel.
Flywheel, let's go.
Yes, exactly. And this flywheel is the early driver of TVL for stablecoins. Right? So that's kind of one of the basic premise of it. So then the question is, how can we actually bootstrap this flywheel? So this is my one weird trick. And that is using signals as a way to bootstrap attention. And why does this matter? First of all, as stablecoin nerds, as most protocol founders are, think we want people to really drive their decisions off of the elegant design that we've come up with. But many of them see that as actually second tier to market signals, right? Which is what is in the news cycle, like what are KOL endorsements looking like? What are the VCs in a project? What FOMO and momentum? So a great go-to-market cannot outrun bad design, but great design is nothing if no one knows about it, right? It's like if the whole tree falls in a forest. So hence the importance of having a go-to-market strategy and execution that is valued as much as the design that you're coming up with. So this is sort of the premise. So then it's, okay, how can we actually make these signals work for us? And I would say that there's no one size fits all, but I wanted to offer some kind of framework that is almost like more on a philosophical level, and you can extrapolate it however you want to into something tangible. But this is what I call the credibility signal waterfall. And maybe if when you're airing this, you can show that waterfall, right? I think you have that diagram. You have that diagram on you, but basically this is a sequential diagram that is meant to indicate like a potent approach to different market segments. So the idea is that if you start at the first segment, it's a lot easier to sell your credibility and your vision to the subsequent one. And there's six steps that build on each other. So imagine six lanes in parallel. And as you move down them, you keep engaging with the former category, but you have built leverage to better engage with the next one. Right. So you don't necessarily need to go from top to bottom, but really it's a guide to get the most out of your effort. So basically, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what are the six lanes of this signal waterfall?
So the first one is the philosopher builders. The second is the VCs. The third is DeFi builders and apps. The fourth is crypto institutions. The fifth are the DeFi degens. And the sixth are the general consumers. So I'm happy to kind of walk through this explanation please. Of what each one is if you'd like as well.
Yeah, this is this is trickle down. It's a trickle down economics. It's a trickle down social attention. Capital. Yeah, trickle down. Yeah.
Yeah, attention, and liquidity, capital. Yeah. So the first category are the philosopher builders. So these are our prolific writer builders. They are, you know, what I consider like the high priests of crypto. They're public intellectuals. They're in pursuit of truth. And they're really adored by subject matter builders. Some examples, and you know, these can change over time, but some examples could be like Vitalik, right? Arthur Hayes, Rune from MakerDAO, maybe Tarun from Gauntlet, Sam from Frax. And you know, an example of you know, how this has been leveraged in you know, stablecoin go-to-markets is when Athena was you know, going for their initial funding round, they already had the endorsement of Arthur Hayes. They had already reached out to him and he came on as a founding advisor. And part of this was they were engaging with a blog post that he had made in the mm-hmm. past yeah. and building a stablecoin design very much inspired by it. All right. So, you know, that's like one example. I'd say even outside of stablecoins, another example is, you know, Mega ETH launching with, you know, Vitalik's endorsement as well. And the key here is, when you are engaging with these philosopher builders, it's not about pitching. It's not even about capital. It's about a Socratic dialogue. Yeah.
Which is very fitting, the name, philosopher builders, like philosopher king.
Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly.
And I think study the Republic.
And this is very unique to crypto. And I think it also indicates like the kind of level of intellectual curiosity that exists in our industry.
What happens in industries outside of crypto? Like what would be considered the top of the signal waterfall and like other industries?
I'm not sure that the signal waterfall would necessarily apply to industries outside of crypto. I'm sure that
because crypto is so, as you said, perception based.
Exactly. It's okay. Like a lot of what causes people to engage with a project is the signals that others are engaging with it as well.
Yeah. Okay. So you have the philosopher builders.
So that's the philosopher builders.
Yeah.
Then the next category, they're the VCs. So these are your VC funds, you know, such as Kraken Ventures. That could also be investment influencers. They could be super angels, whales. The key here is that they mostly underwrite their own conviction, but they still like external signals. With philosopher builders, the reason you go to them first is because they don't necessarily need signals in order to underwrite conviction. Because they are so deep in you know, the subject and they are really intellectually, they're like stimulated by intellectual curiosity and interesting design, they're able to underwrite their own conviction.
The buck stops with themselves. No pun intended.
Yeah.
So that's, then VCs, you know, I think early stage VCs would like to say that they underwrite their own conviction. I think much of the time they do, but they certainly don't mind relying on other signals. Right. But they have to be signals that are relevant to them. Like, you know, if, you know, you came to me and you said, hey, we have 300 retail users and like 5 million TVL, that wouldn't necessarily be the strongest signal. You know, I might take Arthur Hayes endorsing your project as maybe a stronger signal than that. So, you know, examples of VCs, as I said, us at Kraken Ventures, Dragonfly, Andreessen, Electric. And over here, you have like certain group of VCs that are completely financially oriented. And then you have ones such as, say, you know, Coinbase Ventures or OKX, where they're linked to exchanges. And maybe there's some other like strategic element as well. So examples of, you know, this in use is, you know, I know that Frax initially took capital from Dragonfly and Electric. And, you know, Sam has said like great things about, you know, the support that they gave. Athena, also Dragonfly, and you know, ourselves here, think Liquidy is another stablecoin where people have really respected it for design, and mm-hmm. you know, their initial early capital came also from Polychain.
Got it. Yeah, it's that VC stamp of approval.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, and so let's go to the third one. So the VCs, they give their stamp of approval. What goes on next? We'll just go through all of them and then I'll have like probably other questions.
So the third is the DeFi builders and apps. So these are DeFi protocols, right? So the thing is that like the reason this is important is when you're building in DeFi, especially stable coins, leverage is key. And leverage is enabled by composability. So integrations with other DeFi protocols are table stakes for the success of a stablecoin and other DeFi native projects. So mm-hmm. examples of you know, key protocols out there would be like MakerDAO, Curve, Convex, you know, Morpho, Pendle, Trax. And then you know, in our current meta, this is not necessarily a DeFi protocol, but L2 start to become relevant too. So applications of this is, you know, Athena, when they were launching, they, and even after their launch, they were integrating with Synthetics, with Pendle, later, like with Curve, later, like MakerDAO and Spark. And I think that has been like a big contributor, you know, to their initial success as well. Spark, you know, is launching with Morpho and MakerDAO behind them. You know, Frax, I think, is sort of the OG flywheel creator with the convex curve flywheel that really contributed to initial growth. And then, you know, also leaning quite a bit like on Ohm when that was like a big part of the DeFi meta. I think that was also a big part of like Frax's growth strategy.
And I guess you can consider the four pool when Luna was a thing. Like that was like on the precipice of being the ultimate composability thing that was going to happen. But of course, you know, we know what happened. So
yeah, we do know what happened. Yeah, I'm always, it's always awkward to almost like talk about stable coins because there's actually such a like long and awkward zombie yard of them, right? Mm-hmm. So like if I'm talking about any, they have Lindy or, you know, they're somewhat
resale. It's very binary. Yeah. It's either one or zero. It's either pegged or not pegged. I always said that stablecoins are like the brain surgeons of DeFi. Like, you know, because it's quite literally the hardest thing you can do and you have to be perfect. It's like, it's a different type of precision, I feel like, than anything else. So like, especially compared to a DEX.
No, it's so true. Like when I was thinking about like, you know, what matters in a stablecoin go to market, like momentum very much matters, design matters, but and perception matters, but precision is like the fourth thing that really matters.
Yeah. Ooh, so getting those DeFi integrations are key. Okay. So we got those.
The TLDR with DeFi builders is, you know, you need to be able to sell your vision and collaborate with the community. Like in order to enable success of a DeFi protocol, you really can't build as an island if you're building in DeFi.
Yeah.
So the fourth category is crypto institutions. So this, you know, is a couple of different things. It could be centralized exchanges, can be blue chip crypto media, market makers, it can even be conference presence. And this category, they generally do not underwrite their own conviction. But they do co-sign conviction with others. So they definitely rely on signals. And, you know, for example, like if you are getting listed on, you know, like Kraken is looking perhaps to other signals around like the legitimacy of your project and, you know, the potential success or like emerging success of your project, but, you know, might not be like the first one to, list it like when there's absolutely zero signal supporting it, right? So the key here is that you need to be building partnerships, you need to be planting seeds, you need to be taking investment, maybe getting written up, doing private TVL agreements, maybe doing POCs and pilots. And, you know, some examples here, I mean, exchanges, I think we're pretty familiar with Kraken, Binance, Coinbase, OKX, in terms of media, CoinDesk, Blockworks, Flywheel DeFi, Bankless, market makers you might be thinking about, like GSR, Wintermute, right? And you know, some examples of this in action is, you know, I really loved Athena's initial distribution strategy. Like when they were already doing their initial round, they made it a very important point to bring on the support of exchanges in the ecosystem. And this is something I don't normally see. And when I see it, I know that this, you know, project is really building for scale and building for the long term. So, you know, we were part of the investment round, but as Kraken Ventures, they had an agreement with Bybit via Mirana Ventures. They were launching also with like an agreement with OKX, and they also like had a relationship with Binance. I think this is also one of the most like, you know, foolproof ways to launch a stablecoin. Mm-hmm. You know, you have Circle/USDC with Coinbase and then Binance with FDUSD, since, you know, these are major distribution channels.
Yeah, it's fun. I feel like centralized exchanges have grown even more in importance over the past 4 years. I remember when it was DeFi summer, I was like, oh, we can like take on the centralized exchanges. And granted, yes, DeFi like did make a big splash on chain, but that didn't take away like the need for, you know, liquidity where it has been for over a decade.
Yeah. I mean, often that's the difference in true protocols that might be designed similarly, but if one has some kind of relationship to be able to access liquidity from centralized exchanges, your ability to scale is actually superior than if you're only accessing like DEX liquidity.
Yeah,
100%. And in the case of Athena specifically, I think that's a great call out because inherent in the nature of its product, it needs all these exchanges. So the fact that you see these exchanges venture arm or venture division on the cap table, it kind of shows that, like, you know, Guy really thought about how, you know, like you said, the long-term oriented thinking of like, hey, I need these guys in, so let me get them in. And then that just one signals the second one, then the second one signals the third one, then the fourth, all four of them together signals to everybody that like, hey, we're here to build and we have a super deep moat. Like, don't even try to come after us, you know?
Totally. So and it also signals a bit to the exchanges that aren't yet a part of it, right? It's like, okay, so you're going to be the only one, you know, not doing this?
Interesting. It's FOMO. FOMO's real. Yeah, it's real with retail. It's real with exchanges. I've seen it.
Yeah, it is. I think it's very real with, like, especially institutions. Like, if you can get a couple on board, like, of any category, you can definitely go FOMO the others as well.
Yeah, I guess it definitely plays in part of the perception that you were saying before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, so.
Right, the fifth one.
Fifth one.
Yeah.
Right. So the fifth one, this is a DeFi degens, right? So these are your DeFi natives. It's your KOLs. Yeah. It's okay to say that this is mercenary capital or most likely to be mercenary capital. And it's important to know that they are farming liquidity, but they are also farming attention. It's like in crypto, these are both equally valuable resources, right?
Don't you think mercenary capital exists? Like, I guess I would say exists less the higher you go. Like if you're like with like the philosopher builders, like Vitalik, I wouldn't call that mercenary capital, but like down the line, do you think it just gets like a bit more mercenary? And like Arthur Hayes, Arthur Hayes is a trader. Like let's be real. Like he's here to dump on us. He's here to have a good time, but he's here to dump on us. But like, he's like, I kind of view Arthur as kind of like a patrician. Like he'll say, he just says like, this is who I am. Love it or hate it. And people love it.
Well, I mean, I believe they also converted part of their treasury to Athena. So I think, you know, that's the only plan is not to dump in that case, right?
Yes.
But I think this is, I don't think like the lower down you go, you become more mercenary. I think this is in particular like a mercenary step that you have to take, right?
Oh, like, okay.
Yeah. So crypto does not have a paid advertising model. Like in traditional businesses, you know, you might be doing digital advertising, right? Like, you know, various forms of other paid advertising, and crypto doesn't have that. So we use things like KOL endorsements in order to, and you know, putting people on the cap table at preferential terms, right? Like that's sort of crypto's version of paid advertising, love it or hate it. That is sort of like an innovation that has developed in the industry. So this is like, you know, this is the point where maybe you're pre-launch, right? Pre-TG, and you want to get the word out there about what you're building. This is your paid advertising.
Okay, I got it. So every step is, so this step in particular is overtly mercenary because this is the crypto's version of paid advertising.
I think so. Yeah.
Okay. And understood. Got it.
The other important thing here though is that participation of this capital also validates the protocol's implicit security framework because people in this category are willing to be more risk-taking with their capital. So they might be willing to put in, you know, anywhere from a few hundred K to a few million, like, and be first movers in a protocol in return for maybe, you know, higher returns or like preferential yield or, you know, what have you. But then as this like TVL stacks up and this is happening over a period of time before you might go to general retail, you can kind of figure out, is this protocol actually able to, you know, withstand hacks? Is it able to withstand redemptions? Like, is it able to withstand various market events? So this is, I think, actually an important step in also signaling sort of the robustness of your protocol design.
Got it. And these DeFi degens are also the like KOLs in your mind, right? Like the key opinion leaders of that group. Okay, I see.
Yeah, gotcha. Yeah, I think, I mean, KOL has become such a distorted term, right?
Like,
yeah, incredibly distorted.
So, I've been asked to be part of KOL rounds. I'm like, what does that mean? Like, I have, like, I don't know, 3,000 something Twitter followers. Like, I don't think of myself as like a KOL in that regard. Like, since I've gone into VC, like, we have a lot of like restrictions on how we angel invest. So it has kind of been distorted to sort of become this almost like paid to be on the cap table and, you know, paid to
write
like put down great whatever, like on Twitter posts.
Yeah.
I think like in for this particular group, the strategies that you use with them are generational. So, you know, there's like a generation or there still is one that is using you for airdrops. There's strategies right now around like using, you know, doing point farming or using Pendle, which maybe didn't exist in a previous cycle. So the way that you incentivize like within, you know, this like mercenary capital portion, I think, yeah, it changes cycle to cycle.
Right.
And what is that? Yeah, exactly. It's like whatever the meta is. And ideally, like you are the one like creating the meta, but it doesn't seem like people are losers if they're following it either, or copying and pasting it. But so other examples that I want to give here, even just outside of stablecoins. So I mean, within stablecoins, one example actually that I'll give is like when SDAI launched, like they had DSR as 8%, and that was like August of last year.
Mm-hmm.
And that was not like the natural risk-free rate at the time, but they were subsidizing like the yield in order to juice the incentives to get people to like hold SDAI, right? When Athena launched, they had SAT campaign, shards campaign. And then like outside of crypto, I want to give an example of where people are farming attention and not liquidity, but it's still very much a tactic. VeraChain with Vera Baddies, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that there's many ways to kind of play within this category.
What are the bear baddies doing?
What are the bear baddies doing? They're being bear baddies online.
They're being bear baddies. Yeah.
they're
bear baddies.
Yeah. I was not asked to be one, but you know, like if any stablecoins want to like launch the equivalent, like I might be down. Yeah, stablecoin baddie.
You heard it here first, dude. He's down to be a stable baddie.
Stable baddie. Or, yeah.
Unstable baddie. I like it.
Unstable baddie. All three of us. We're all down for it.
Kit, you'll be an unstable daddy.
Oh, wow. Daddy.
Yeah, no.
Okay.
That's true. All right. Let's roll it back.
Back on topic.
All right. Okay. So DeFi degen, the next thing down the signal waterfall are?
Yes. Then the sixth category, this is the general consumers, right? So by the time you get here, I think you would have wanted to build up all these signals across the previous categories in order to, you know, validate, you know, the protocol, the credibility, the robustness, et cetera. And the general consumers are your organic users. And they are the ones that are giving the protocol, you know, this phrase that, you know, Sam from Frax shared with me, they're the ones that are giving the protocol monetary premium. So they are the ones that will sustain the protocol without subsidized incentives, right? So I mean, some examples of this is like USDT on Tron being used in emerging markets, USDC being used as DeFi trading pairs, DAI being used like as DAO treasury collateral, and Athena being used as treasury counterparty risk diversification away from fiat.
So this, even though it's the last category, the last bucket of this waterfall, it's the final arbiter. It's the final that says like, this is going to make it or this is going to not make it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the signals that you can garner from, you know, these steps before, I think that they are good growth strategies, but at some point you have to be able to sustain your growth without subsidization. And this category is going to be the one that determines if you're able to do that or not.
Yeah. Let's actually expand on that. Cause one of the questions I have here is like, how can, you have a successful go-to-market, but how can it be sustained? Like, how do you like have a successful stablecoin 6 months, a year, 2 years out? Oh, wait, Kit, were you
actually, before we hop into that, I wanted to add one more question about the waterfall signal here.
It's okay.
You know, based on each of these like levels, which one has, I guess, the most leverage to do? Like, which one comes with the most capital? Which one comes with the most attention, you know, most attention and liquidity bang for your buck, right?
Most bang for your buck. So, I mean, the way I think about it, like when I think bang for your buck, it's like, how much effort do I need to put in to get a return? And the way that I've set this up is so that it is sequential. So I think you get the most bang for your buck if like Vitalik is co-signing what you're working on, right? Because then I think it makes it a lot easier to open up subsequent conversations. Like if you go directly to retail and you try to put together like $1 billion protocol starting, you know, with general consumers, I think that's going to be, that's pretty hard. Like to go straight there and not have accumulated credibility, attention, liquidity from these other categories. So the way that I have structured this, as I said, it's art, not science, but it's like increasing leverage.
Got it. So in theory, I guess in practice, like one could skip a step here and there. It's just like the balance of effort it takes, effort and what you get out of it is like more or less.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, okay. I think Frax is a great example that maybe didn't start at that very top, but you know, there were the VCs involved in the early stage, but I think that Frax put a lot of weight on the, you know, DeFi builders and apps portion with like Convex, Curve, and Ohm. And you know, even now, like I think Frax kind of maintains a position in the ecosystem by being quote unquote stablecoin maximalist. And making
it's,
sure
it's
that
it's the L2. The L2 gives leverage too.
Yeah.
It's like a whole nother dimension.
Yeah. The fractal dimension.
The fractal dimension. I like that.
In your presentation, you also had this really cool flywheel effect where it's like attention gets liquidity, liquidity gets attention, attention gets liquidity. And like applying it onto this kind of vertical waterfall, you kind of see it like certain layers may not come with a ton of liquidity. For example, the philosopher builders, right? They may not inject a ton of liquidity, but they have maximum attention. Right. And then conversely, going on the VC route, maybe it's like an even split between attention and liquidity there. Then the DeFi builders is actually, you know, if Frax didn't have Convex or Curve, then it may not have gotten all the attention nor the liquidity, right? Because Convex and Curve gave it that yield of flywheel. So I could see like the attention and the liquidity as like the two levers as you kind of pull on as you go through each of these tiers. Like, okay, I get the most attention here. I get the most liquidity here, which leads to most attention on the next tier. So that's a really fun back and forth that I'm seeing.
Yeah, totally. And like, you know, this is supposed to be positive, uplifting, a great guide. But, you know, I could also make a un-go-to-market presentation, which is just going in the opposite direction where you're getting like bad attention and then reducing liquidity and getting worse attention and reducing liquidity even more until like keep doing that and losing credibility with everyone until you hit zero, which is kind of what happened with like Terra Luna, right? Yeah. So I think that this flywheel, like it works
it goes
in both
ways.
Yeah, it works in both directions. It helps go to market and it helps you get out of the market too.
It's basically an energy exchange, and the energy sometimes is intellectual attention, endorsements. The energy is attention, and then the energy is actual liquidity and like actual value and money. And it just keeps like siphoning, like not siphoning, but like it alternates like, oh, attention, liquidity, attention, value. And it's just all energy.
And now let's go to Dave's question about now that we went to the market, how do we stay in the market, right? And I don't want to add a second layer to that is like, do you need to think about how you stay in the market with each of these guys, like from the philosophy builder, how do you keep them engaged, how do you keep like the DeFi builders engaged, etc., etc.?
So in terms of you know, getting beyond just the go to the market and staying in the market, this ties to what I said with the general consumers, right? I think if you really are planning to win long term, you need a plan for your protocol to have monetary premium. So you need a plan where actually you pull back your incentives and people continue to hold you without being subsidized. So that is all about use cases. I think, you know, farming, that is a growth strategy, like to some extent, but use cases, I mean, they can be within DeFi, they can be outside of DeFi, but that's what's important. And, you know, some examples of use cases, I already covered some, but, you know, when a asset is accepted in other DeFi protocols as collateral or as trading pairs, I think that's like a very real use case. When an asset is an acceptable means of payments and remittances. I think that's like another very powerful use case. Another one is if it is considered a store of value, especially, you know, this is validated in unstable economies. And then, you know, one that I think is very important and sometimes like not mentioned is just democratizing access to yield. I don't think that yield is degen. Like, you know, in traditional finance, people, all kinds of people get yield, and often, you know, you're, it's accessible to you based off of what your net worth already is, right? Mm-hmm. And I think in DeFi, we have the opportunity to actually democratize that access to yield, regardless of what your net worth is already. And then, you know, I think there's other really interesting emerging use cases, such as being used, you know, stablecoins being used as a unit for exchange in FX commodities trading, because it reduces the settlement time when, say, somebody from Indonesia sends something to someone in, you know, the Middle East, like instead of, you know, this commodity like sitting at like a port for a couple of days while local banking, you know, manages like that exchange with stablecoins, it can happen in T0 timing. So, and I'm very much like on the lookout for these like interesting emerging use cases. But really being able to nail use cases is the key to sustaining long-term success.
Okay, I got it. So it's one thing to go to market, but like then you have to have a reason for the stablecoin to exist beyond just token incentive. So it could be organic yield-bearing vaults. It could be being used as collateral. It could be buying a banana. It could be a lot of things.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's, think it's really hard to have a protocol that lasts more than one cycle without it.
Yeah. And so I want to go back a sec to like successful go-to-markets. Can we go through Athena as like an example? I know we kind of like went through it in like flashes and stuff.
Yeah.
But can we like give like the whole picture of it? And I remember you saying to me, that you even asked like Guy or someone saying like, how'd you do it? And he's like, I don't know. It just kind of happened. Not that he said that it kind of happened, but like, it's kind of like, I feel like when you're like in the thick of it, like coming, like, let me go back. I feel like you can have like the best strategy possible, but it isn't the right time for something. Then it's hard for like something to take off. I feel like something like Athena, like it was the perfect, like, I think they hit the timing right on everything. I think I had the timing right on like when they launched and on their like Shards and Sats campaign, when they did their airdrop, and like every single part of their like go to market was just like done like pretty flawlessly in terms of time. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I think they actually had a like very strong go to market plan, like, you know, when I was also evaluating them. But the thing that nobody could have predicted was, yeah, how great market timing was and how much funding rates were in the favor of this launch at that time. Mm-hmm. But to some extent, they, like, it's not that they had predicted that, but they were also trying to make sure that they're creating a protocol that can withstand, you know, multiple funding rate environments. But yeah, this turned out to be very good timing. Maybe what would be helpful, let me know, but I can kind of give you like my framework of, you know, how I evaluate like the potential success of a stablecoin project like, as a VC, and then, you know, map how Athena and maybe others like fell into that, like as I was evaluating them, and then how I think it's like further contributed to that.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Yeah. So basically I have a framework that has two categories. One is, what do I know or what can I learn as a VC that maybe like retail isn't likely to know, right? And then the next thing is considering how would a smart consumer evaluate like a project as well? So on the former, as a VC, I'm looking for edge, right? So I'm looking for edge across kind of four basic categories. And this is very, as I said, very stablecoin oriented. This isn't necessarily a framework for evaluating like a L1 or L2. So on the former, I look for edge across first team. So do they have unique insights on the space they're building in? Do they have unique and relevant experience? Do they have a like killer network? You know, the second thing is legal and regulatory. So this is maybe preferential, like jurisdictional arbitrage, finding ways to be bankruptcy remote, or finding like interesting licensing they can get. And this is also connections in regulatory and policy. The third is distribution. So what is their distribution strategy? So you know, you can have an amazing design, but if you don't have a distribution strategy, no one's going to be there for it. So you know, this could be centralized exchange partnerships, it's DeFi composability, it's APIs, it's go-to-market campaigns and more. And then finally, cost structure. Like if you're able to find a way to get cost structure that mainly, you know, that might only be afforded to some others at scale, but earlier, you know, in your company formation, then that is a huge step up versus others. So these are some categories, like, you know, for me as a VC, I can, you know, look for edge. And a company does not need to have edge across all of these. It's quite okay if they're just really, really strong in like one or two of these. And it's okay, like if they're like weak in one of the others. So then I'm like, okay, what would a smart consumer consider? And you would also love your input here because you, know, you are the smart consumers in this case.
I don't
case.
Think I'm that smart, but okay, thank you.
No, come on. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, like, it is funny because, like, the smart consumers we're talking about are on Twitter literally hashtagging, like, Remilio and Retardio. But, yeah these are our smart consumers indeed. So the first thing is composability. So I think people are thinking about how can they use it throughout the ecosystem. You know, you have a lot of projects, especially like RWAs that launch like actually not being permissionless and not being composable. And I think often they have some trouble like taking off for this reason. The next is incentives and incentive engineering. So this is yield. This is airdrops. This is just how can we juice the deal, right? As a smart, for a smart consumer. Then there's considering the risk profile. So this might be like collateral ratio, collateral type, centralization risks, regulatory risks. There. Fourth, we have peg stability. And how are they planning to manage that? Fifth, it's redemption mechanisms. And then sixth, it's use cases. Like where can they use it? All right. So basically, I would like very informally score a stablecoin across like, you know, these two buckets, like A, B, C, B, smart consumer. And then I ask, how will its strengths set it apart from other stablecoins, right? And you could have a stablecoin with a lot of very, very unique strengths, but how deep and wide will the liquidity be that's likely to form under it? So, you know, you might be extremely niche, but actually maybe that market is not huge. So, you know, there's always like trade-offs over here. So then after that, I ask, where does long-term value accrue? So VCs are not looking for quick clips or just for yield, right? We need exponential outcomes, and understanding that token and equity structure is very important for that. And this also generally helps me align with projects that are also seeking long-term success. Since I think that there's a lot of DeFi protocols that are at peace with maybe like, you know, existing for, you know, one and a half cycles. But then it'll become like very clear in terms of like their value accrual structure that they are not necessarily building for the long-term. So basically, you know, I consider all of this and then I'm like, okay, is this a stablecoin then that I want to invest in or not? And to some extent, this framework works for some other DeFi protocols too.
Who's going to be here to last?
What is that?
I said, who's going to be here to last?
Yeah, exactly.
That is
who will still be here. Yeah. And hopefully not the, what is it like, you know, like die a hero or live long enough to become a villain. That can sometimes happen in crypto too.
Many such cases.
So many such cases.
Yeah.
So
I feel like this cycle, there hasn't really been a main character. I feel like maybe Alon, the Pumped Out Fun guy, is kind of becoming one. I guess Anson will be one. But like, no, there hasn't been like a DeFi main character in the same way there was like Doquan. I mean, SBF was a centralized, I mean, he was FTX, but like he still did a lot of DeFi stuff with Alameda. But there hasn't been like, you know what I mean? I guess we have still time for things to play out, but we'll see.
And when we like crown someone a main character, are we also like saying that they like might be there might be like a downfall in their future? I'm like nervous to like speculate on main characters.
It depends how they conduct themselves in public. If they're like a main character and they get cocky and they let ego and pride get the best of them, well, I feel like this is like what every ancient Greek tragedy like happens in every ancient Greek tragedy. Like the gods will smite them. Smite them. Smite. But yeah.
Only if they are a philosopher main character, then they can remain. Yes.
So I was going to say, I feel that the kind of the cycle of like main characters is also increasing. Like there was that like Choose Rich guy, right?
Oh, yeah, Nick.
Mm-hmm. I feel like he was like a main character for like a solid week. Not necessarily as like a DeFi builder, but he was, I do think he was kind of like main Twitter character for like
those who get attentions to themselves for the sake of it, like for the sake of themselves. Like Do Kwon, perfect example of that. Just like really rallying up the pot, stirring up the pot.
Or maybe it's like, you know, some of these meme coins have been main characters in different parts of this cycle.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Like Wif has been a main character. Mog has been a main character. For a moment.
Yeah, exactly. Mog. Mm-hmm. Yeah. They kind of feel main character-y to me.
I guess. Yeah. Can main characters not be people? Can they be protocols? That is, or like tokens themselves? Mm-hmm. I guess so.
I think so because Olympus DAO, for example, we take it real back, right? Olympus is technically the whole of it was a main character, right? Yeah, you don't know each individual person.
And like, I mean, like a whole is the sum of its parts. So,
yeah
I guess, good point. Different levels.
I know we're running up to the tail end here, but I would love to ask this question because I've been kind of grappling this with myself. It's like, as a stablecoin project, does success mean that you have to scale to multi-billion dollars and become the de facto store of value, medium of exchange, or whatever? Or is it okay for you to be like maybe, you know, mid nine figures, but you dominate your niche, right? Yeah. You are the stable coin for remittances into Ecuador, right? Like, is that okay? So I've been kind of grappling with this. It feels like, kind of feels like a cop out if you go for the smaller end, but also you own 100% of the market. Like, that's amazing. Versus going up against titans like Circle and Tether.
Yeah. So, I mean, as a, like, from the venture perspective, like, yes, I want a stable coin to be worth, you know, billions of dollars and, like, have that much TVL, because that's like a success for me, right? In terms of, you know, what my portfolio construction looks like and what return. Expectations look like, right? But then I think for stablecoins themselves, the thing is these are very network effect driven businesses. So I think it's a bit hard to be a very small stablecoin and not constantly struggling to like bring yourself back up to like the top 5 to 10 in the market. Because there's a very, very long zombie yard of stablecoins. Like if you go on CoinGecko or whatever, there's like hundreds that have sub 80, 50 million TVL. So I think, you know, by the kind of market dynamics of this business, usually your protocol does benefit from scale in terms of value that you can also provide to the users within the protocol. So unless you're doing something like that really doesn't benefit from that, or like somehow has only geographic network effects, which I haven't really seen too much of. Mm-hmm. I do think that, you have to be aiming to kind of break through like a certain network threshold to continue to be useful and basically also to not continue to subsidize, what you're building. I think if you don't take any investor money and you build something where people are using it despite you not subsidizing it, then that probably is some form of success, right? But if, usually in order to like keep a certain position, people are bleeding themselves dry in order to just keep trying to subsidize their growth and like maintaining that position.
Network effects matter.
Network effects are the most important like driver in DeFi.
Yeah. And, this is one of those questions, but then this kind of leads to almost a winner takes all or winner takes most market, right? Because you can only have so many network effects. And right now, is it possible in your mind for a stable coin to take market share away from Tether and USDC? And if so, like, what are some potential angles that are exciting to you to make that happen?
Yeah. So I would call myself stablecoin maximalist, stablecoin maxi. I do think that there's space in the market for multiple stablecoins. The key thing here is that the pie is getting bigger and more sophisticated, and also different type of investors are coming into crypto with like different risk and return profiles. And I think stablecoins, they're represented as being, you know, pegged to fiat, let's just say like, one US dollar, but increasingly in the background, you can have kind of different types of financial protocols that are being built around it. So it's, you know, nice for like, trading pairs and collateral management and, you know, other forms of accounting and transactional management for it to be denominated in one, but to be able to kind of like fluctuate, like, you know, what the return or, you know, the value to the holder is, like, you know, with some kind of like paired token that captures that, I think that there's like a lot of opportunity for that. And I think like, I mean, just like a few examples, like I think Athena's proposal to the market is very different than a Tether. Right. I think, you know, like, I mean, I'll just actually compare it even to like USDC. So people consider like USDC, this like higher trust, US dollar pegged, like institutionally accepted stablecoin. And in some cases, you're getting like a little bit of yield from it, depending on where you're holding it. But you are taking on the counterparty risk of fiat and like of central banking. And to some extent, that is fine. But if we think back to Silicon Valley Bank collapse last year, there was a moment where USDC like pegged very severely and it went, you know, below 90 cents. And there was a lot of people that seriously thought that, you know, their USDC might not be worth anything, right? Because it kind of had actually the counterparty risk in that case of regional banking, because they are being held at Silicon Valley Bank. And therefore, they were also being exposed to the liability side of Silicon Valley Bank. In this case, I mean, it is not maybe more or less risky, but it is different risk to also be holding Athena, like if you are managing your treasury. And that's not something that's just for crypto treasuries. That could be for any startup treasury. There is a lot of startups that struggled when SVB went down. So it's, I mean, the risk that you're taking there is a little more, it's more on like, you know, centralized exchanges. It's a little more like on crypto native assets. But it's a different kind of risk. So I think that that's a great example of, you know, a stablecoin still having a kind of utility that is different from Tether, and definitely being able to like, one, make a dent in that market share, but two, just expanding the pie for everybody. So I just totally see stablecoins as a growth asset. And, you know, we've invested in a couple, and it's because we don't actually think they're going to be competing with each other. We think that each of them are tailored to different market segments, and they're offering something more appealing or even complementary to USDT and USDC.
Understood. Yeah, there's enough room to go around. There's enough. There's enough room to go around for growth.
I think it's predicated on the size of the market of your use case and your utility. Right. I think that's the more concrete way of kind of packaging it up. It's like, you know, there could be multiple stable coins and you're willing to invest into them as long as their ideal use case or their target customer is a big enough TAM for it to make sense.
Exactly. I mean, that's like kind of one of the first things, like, you know, in that VC framework, which is what are the unique strengths? And then are there enough customers, you know, for these strengths? And I actually think like Tether, I mean, you know, like I totally respect like their dominance in like emerging market payments. But, you know, the usual is like a kind of rising, like an emerging competitor, right? And within a few weeks, they have like almost 200 million TVL. And like the key here is they're sharing all of the profits that they're making. So, you know, you can, if you're buying usual, like, yes, you get access to the risk-free rate, but then you can also use usual for, you know, looping and leverage, like within the DeFi ecosystem, you can do things that you can do with Tether as well, except, you know, you actually get access to the company's upside and, you know, to the yield that's being generated. So, you know, there's, you know, one would say that there's got to be a market for that. And, you know, some of their early growth is indicating that. So that's kind of some of the things that I look for. I'm like, is there enough people that, or enough kind of market segments that would actually want what the unique like strength of this stablecoin is?
Got it. Yeah. The usual makes everything casual. access. Sorry, that was the first thing that came to my head. Like, oh, like you can, like, oh, you can have access to like things that you didn't have access for with a Tether and whatnot.
Yeah, or it's in that case, it's like you can have access to certain aspects of like yield and like profit sharing, essentially. Mm-hmm. Think of it as like a co-op, right?
Yeah.
That you wouldn't have access to in Tether. But then there's a lot of RWA protocols, which, you know, you will get access to maybe just the yield, but then they're not permissionless and composable, so you can't actually use them throughout the DeFi ecosystem. So like in that case, our evaluation was that we do think there's people that both want that yield, but they also want leverage. So, you know, that's kind of the market that they're targeting. And, you know, we think that market is big enough.
Yeah. Yeah, I think this is a good place to wrap it up. But before we go, we always have one question for our guests. This one is, who would you recommend to be on Flywheel? Who would you want to see here next?
Oh, who would I want to see here next? Huh. I feel you've had so many of the people that I have. Well, okay, let me ask you, have you had like Guy from Athena on?
We've had on Seraphim, but not Guy.
We had Seraphim, okay, he's very, yeah, very interesting. Okay, I think like having Guy, that would be very interesting, especially when you think about some of Athena's like expansion plans right now.
Mm-hmm. Oh, sure. Good point.
Yeah, like, yeah. So another one would be, have you had Rune recently?
We've had Rune on last year.
We had Rune, yeah.
Yeah, you had Rune on last year. Yeah, I think, mm-hmm. I mean, some kind of like refresher on like what's happening with MakerDAO. Actually, linked to that, I don't know if have you had Sam from Spark?
No, but I would love to have Sam on.
I think that would be like a really cool one. Because Spark also sat in like the middle of like the MakerDAO Aave Morpho, like that whole kind of not even controversy, but that heat that like came onto crypto Twitter, like, and it has been coming on and off. So I think that could be another cool one.
I like those. Yeah. True DeFi ones. But Studi, before we go, where can people find you? Where can people find Kraken Ventures?
Sure. So you can find me on Twitter. It is my first name. So Stuti, Stuti, Real, Real. I made that because at some point I had some like impersonator. And so I was like, okay, that's
the
like
real Studi.
So I'm like, I'll just make, it's like Studi Real. Like that makes total sense. So yeah, Stuti Real on Twitter and then Kraken Ventures. I mean, really just reach out to me on Twitter. That's the best way. We have a website. We're revamping it. It's like looking a little,
it's going to look like Berkshire Hathaway.
Yeah, like our website, we're going to have a really cool website up soon. But,
soon TM.
But for now, just, you know, come through to us directly through me. And yeah, I'll be at Token 2049 DevCon, and you can find me year round in San Francisco and Berlin.
Awesome. You heard it here. Studi, thank you so much. And we hope to see you soon.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Welcome to the Post Game Show. I'm your host, DeFi Dave, here with Capital K. And we are just wrapping up an episode with Studi of Kraken Ventures. I really like this episode because I think we're talking about it after. Like, there aren't that many like videos or interviews where people actually go to markets, let alone like not just for stablecoins, but let alone for like any project in crypto.
Right.
And it's such a different type of approach compared to traditional consumer, Web2, TradFi, or like whatever else. It's like, because it's so perception driven. So like she did a great job. She thought deeply about this. She did a great job explaining everything, breaking down that signal waterfall that I think all builders and founders can keep in mind. And also like gives like your standard users like are like different people on the signal waterfall framework of thinking like, hey, like where should I look to? And like, hey, like how should I expect to be going down the line? Kit, what are your thoughts on this one?
Yeah, I mean, in addition to the signal waterfall, she also shared how she kind of assess a project, right? Outside of just the waterfall that she thinks about, like, in terms of a VC, she looks for edge, just like most, right? Is it in the team? Is it in the regulation? Is it in the cost structure? But on the other side, as a consumer, she also thinks about what is the edge there. Is it the market? Is it the geography? Is it the use case, the utility? So she really provides like a really great framework. And we're going to share the deck, I believe, also with this as a link in the description. So you guys can go through the deck and kind of understand how she sees things. And this is Kraken Ventures. You know, they are a big name in the space. And if this is a framework that they're kind of using, I think, you know, a shrewd listener would go and look at this PowerPoint. That's all I can say.
Yeah, absolutely. And we'll have that below. But before we go, because I'd love to have Sudhi on again. I'm curious, what would be an update on this? So when we do have it on again, you know what to do. Hit that bell button, subscribe, go in the comments, let us know what you think. Give us a like, follow us on all of our socials on X, TikTok, and Telegram at Flybo DeFi. I miss saying Twitter. Maybe I'll say Twitter on the next one. Make sure you follow me on Twitter at DeFiDave22.
You follow me at 0xCapital_K.
And we'll see you next week. Peace.
Peace.
Everything said on this episode is not financial or tax advice. This channel is strictly for educational purposes and is not in investment advice or solicitation to buy or sell any assets or to make any financial decisions. This video is not tax advice whatsoever. Please talk to your accountant and do your own research.